It was another wild goose chase. Gary was absolutely convinced of it, though, of course, he would never be foolhardy enough to say so. Even the thought made him feel guilty, and he glanced sideways at the woman he loved. Anna had learned English and lost a little weight in the 18 short sweet months since he had met her, and the latter was the only circumstance in his life he would have altered. If it had been in his power. Indeed, he was always urging food upon her. There was a German patisserie and confectioner's opposite the Kaiserhof Hotel in Windhoek, where Gary had taken a permanent suite. He never passed the shop without going in to buy a box of the marvellous black chocolates or a creamy cake. Black Forest cherry cake was a favourite, which he took back to Anna. When he carved, he always reserved the fattest, juiciest cuts for her and replenished the plate without allowing her time to protest. However, she had still lost weight. They didn't spend enough time in the hotel suite, he brooded. They spent too much of their time chasing about the bush, as they were doing now. No sooner had he put a few pounds on her than they were off again, banging and jolting over remote tracks in the open Fiat Tourer that had replaced the T-model Ford, or when the tracks faded, resorting to horses and mules to carry them over rugged ranges of mountains or through the yawning canyons and rock deserts of the interior, chasing the will-o'-the-wisp of rumour and chance and often of deliberately misleading information. "The crazy old people, the Twir o' Onbeskofters," that was the title which they had gained themselves from one end of the territory to the other. And Gary took a perverse and defiant pleasure in the fact that he had earned it the hard way. When he had totted up the actual cost in hard cash of the continuing search, he had been utterly appalled until suddenly he had thought, "What else have I got to spend it on anyway except Anna?" And then, after a little further reflection, "What else is there except Anna?" And with that discovery, he had thrown himself headlong into the madness. Of course, sometimes when he woke in the night and thought about it clearly and sensibly, he knew that his grandson did not exist. He knew that the daughter-in-law that he had never seen had drowned 18 months ago, out there in the cold green waters of the Atlantic, taking with her the last contact he could ever have with Michael. Then that terrible sorrow came upon him once again, threatening to crush him, until he groped for Anna in the bed beside him and crept to her, and even in her sleep she seemed to sense his need, and she would roll towards him and take him to her. Then in the morning he awoke refreshed and revitalized, logic banished, and blind faith restored, ready to set out on the next fantastic adventure that awaited them. Gary had arranged for 5,000 posters to be printed in Cape Town and distributed to every police station, magistrate's court, post office and railway station in southwest Africa. Wherever he and Anna travelled, there was always a bundle of posters on the back seat of the Fiat or in one of the saddlebags, and they stuck them on every blank wall of every general dealer's or barroom they passed. They nailed them to tree trunks at desolate crossroads in the deep bush, and with a bribe of a handful of sweets, dished them out to black and white and brown urchins they met on the roadside, with instructions to take them to their homestead or kraal or camp, and hand them to their elders. £5,000 reward, £5,000. For information leading to the rescue of Santin de Thierry Courtney, a survivor of the hospital ship Protea Castle, most barbarously torpedoed by a German submarine on the 28th of August 1917 off the coast north of Swakopmund. Mrs. Courtney would have been cast ashore and may be in the care of wild tribesmen or alone in the wilderness. Any information concerning her whereabouts should be conveyed to the undersigned at the Kaiserhof Hotel Windhoek, Lieutenant Colonel G. C. Courtney. £5,000 was a fortune. 20 years' salary for the average working man. Enough to buy a ranch and stock it with cattle and sheep. Enough to provide a man with a secure living for his entire life. And there were dozens eager to try for the reward or for any lesser amount that they could wheedle out of Gary by vague promises and fanciful stories and outright lies. In the Kaiserhof suite, he and Anna interviewed hopefuls who had never ventured beyond the line of rail, but were willing to lead expeditions into the desert. Others who knew exactly where the lost girl could be found, still others who had actually seen Santan, only needed a grubstake of £1,000 to go and fetch her in. There were spiritualists and clairvoyants who were in constant contact with her on a higher plane, and even one gentleman who offered to sell his own daughter at a bargain rate to replace the missing girl. Gary met them all, cheerfully. He listened to their stories and chased their theories and instructions or sat around an Ouija board with the spiritualists, even followed one of them who was using one of Santan's rings suspended on a piece of string as a lodestone on a 500-mile pilgrimage through the desert. He was presented with a number of young ladies, varying in texture and colour from blonde to café au lait, all claiming to be Santan de Thierry Courtney, or willing to do for him anything that she could do. Some of them became loudly abusive when they were refused and had to be evicted from the suite by Anna in person. "No wonder she's losing weight," Gary told himself, and leaned over to pat Anna's thigh as she sat beside him in the open Fiat Tourer. The words of the blasphemous old Grace came into his mind. "We thank the Lord for what we have, but for a little more we would be glad." He grinned at her fondly, and aloud he told her, "We should be there soon." She nodded and replied, "This time I know we will find her. I have a sure feeling." "Yes," Gary agreed dutifully. "This time will be different." He was quite safe in that assertion. No other of their many expeditions had begun in such a mysterious manner. One of their own reward posters had arrived folded upon itself and sealed with wax, bearing a postmark dated 4 days previously at Usakos, a way station on the narrow-gauge railway line halfway between Windhoek and the coast. The package was unstamped. Gary had been obliged to pay the postage, and it was addressed in a bold but educated hand, the script unmistakably German. When Gary split the wax and unfolded it, he found a laconic invitation to a rendezvous written on the foot of the sheet and a hand-drawn map to guide him. The sheet was unsigned. Gary immediately telegraphed the postmaster at Usakos, confident that the volume of business at such a remote station would be so low that the postmaster would remember every package handed in for postage. The postmaster did indeed recall the package and the circumstances of its delivery. It had been left on the threshold of the post office during the night, and nobody had even glimpsed the correspondent. As the writer probably intended, all this intrigued both Gary and Anna, and they were eager to keep the rendezvous. It was set for a site in the barren Kamas-Hochland, 150 miles from Windhoek. It had taken them all of 3 days to negotiate the atrocious roads, but after losing themselves at least a dozen times, changing approximately the same number of punctured tyres, and sleeping rough on the hard ground beside the Fiat, they had now almost reached the appointed meeting place. The sun blazed down from a cloudless sky, and the breeze from behind blew eddies of red dust over them as they rattled and rumbled over the stony ruts. Anna seemed impervious to all the heat and dust and hardship of the desert, and Gary, gazing at her in unstinted admiration, almost missed the next tight bend in the track. His off-wheel skidded over the verge, and the fear teetered and rocked over the yawning void that opened abruptly before them. He hauled the steering over, and as they bumped back into the wheel ruts, he pulled on the handbrake. They were on the rim of a deep canyon that cut the plateau like an axe stroke. The track descended into the depths in a series of hairpin twists like the contortions of a maimed serpent, and hundreds of feet below them, the river was a narrow ribbon that threw dazzling reflections of the noon sun up the orange-coloured cliffs. "This is the place," Gary told her, "and I don't like it. Down there we will be at the mercy of any bandit or murderer."
"Mynheer, we are already late for the meeting."
"I don't know if we will ever get out of there again, and God knows nobody is likely to find us here. Probably just our bare bones."
"Come, Mynheer, we can talk later."
Gary drew a deep breath. Sometimes there were distinct drawbacks to being paired with a strong-willed woman. He let off the handbrake and the Fiat rolled over the rim of the canyon, and once they were committed, there was no turning back. It was a nightmare descent, the gradient so steep that the brake shoes smoked, and the hairpin bends so tight that he had to go back and fill to coax the Fiat through them. "Now I know why our friend chose this place. He has us at his mercy down here." 40 minutes later, they came out in the gut of the canyon. The walls above them were so sheer that they blotted out the sun. They were in shadow, but it was stiflingly hot. No breeze reached down here, and the air had a flinty bite on the back of the throat. There was a narrow strip of level land on each bank of the river, covered with coarse thorn growth, and Gary backed the Fiat off the track, and they climbed down stiffly and beat the red dust from their clothing. The stream bubbled sullenly over a low causeway of rock, and the water was opaque and a poisonous yellow colour, like the effluent from a chemical factory. "Well," Gary surveyed both banks and the cliffs above them, "we seem to have the place to ourselves. Our friend is nowhere to be seen."
"We will wait."
Anna forestalled the suggestion she knew was coming. "Of course, mevrouw." Gary lifted his hat and mopped his face with a cotton bandana from around his neck. "May I suggest a cup of tea?" Anna took the kettle and went down the bank. She tasted the river water suspiciously and then filled it. When she climbed back, Gary had a fire of thornwood crackling between two hearthstones. While the kettle boiled, Gary fetched a blanket from the back of the Fiat and the bottle of schnapps from the cubbyhole. He poured a liberal dram into each of the mugs, added a heaped spoon of sugar, then topped them up with strong hot tea. He had found that schnapps, like chocolate, had a most tempering effect on Anna, and he was never without a bottle. Perhaps the journey would not be entirely wasted, he thought, as he added another judicious splash of spirits to Anna's mug and carried it to her, where she sat in the middle of the rug. Before he reached her, Gary let out a startled cry and dropped the mug, splashing his boots with hot tea. He stood, staring into the bush behind her, and raised both hands high above his head. Anna glanced round and then bounded to her feet and seized a brand of firewood, which she brandished before her. Gary edged swiftly to her side and stood close to her protective bulk.
"Keep away," Anna bellowed. "I warn you, I'll break the first skull."
They were surrounded. The gang had crept up on them through the dense bush.
"Oh, Lord, I knew it was a trap," Gary muttered.
They were almost certainly the most dangerous-looking band of cutthroats he had ever seen.
"We have no money, nothing worth stealing."
How many of them? He wondered desperately. Three? No, there was another behind that tree. Four murderous ruffians. The obvious leader was a purple-black giant with bandoliers of ammunition criss-crossing his chest and a Mauser rifle in the crook of his arm. A ruff of thick woolly beard framed his broad African features like the mane of a man-eating lion. The others were all armed, a mixed brand of Khoisan Hottentots and a Vumbo tribesman, wearing odd items of military uniform and civilian clothing, all of it heavily worn and faded, patched and tattered, some of them barefooted, and others with scuffed boots, shapeless and battered from hard marches. Only their weapons were well cared for, glistening with oil and borne lovingly, almost the way a father might carry his firstborn son. Gary thought fleetingly of the service revolver he kept holstered under the dashboard of the Fiat, and then swiftly abandoned such a reckless notion.
"Don't harm us,"
he pleaded, crowding up behind Anna. And then, with a feeling of utter disbelief, Gary found himself abandoned as Anna launched her attack. Swinging the burning log like a Viking's axe, she charged straight at the huge black leader.
"Back, you swine!" she roared in Flemish. "Get out of here, you bitch-born son of Hades!"
Taken by surprise, the gang scattered in pandemonium, trying to duck the smoking log as it hissed about their heads.
"How dare you, you stinking bastard spawn of diseased whores!"
Still shaking with shock, Gary stared after her, torn between terror and admiration for this new revelation of his lover's accomplishments. He had heard some great cursers in his life. There had been the legendary Sergeant Major whom he had known during the Zulu Rebellion. Men travelled miles to listen to him addressing a parade ground. The man was a Sunday school preacher in comparison. Gary could have charged admission fees to Anna's performance. Her eloquence was matched only by her dexterity with a log. She caught one of the Hottentots, a crashing blow between the shoulders, and he was hurled into a thorn bush, his jacket smoking with live coals, shrieking like a wounded warthog. Two others, reluctant to face Anna's wrath, leaped over the riverbank and disappeared with high splashes beneath the yellow waters. That left only the big black Avumbo to bear the full brunt of Anna's onslaught. He was quick and agile for such a big man, and he avoided the wild swings of the log and danced behind the nearest camel-thorn tree. With nimble footwork, he kept the trunk between Anna and himself until at last she stopped, gasping and red-faced, and panted at him.
"Come out, you yellow-bellied, black-faced apology for a blue-testicle baboon!"
Gary noticed with awe how she managed to cram the metaphor with colour.
"Come out where I can kill you!"
Wearily, the Ovambo declined, backing out of reach.
"No, no, we did not come to fight you, we came to fetch you," he answered in Afrikaans.
She lowered the log slowly.
"Did you write the letter?"
And the Ovambo shook his head.
"I have come to take you to the man who did."
The Ovambo ordered two of his men to remain and guard the Fiat. Then he led them away along the floor of the canyon. Although there were stretches of open, easy going on the river bank, there were also narrow gorges through which the river roared and swirled, and the path was steep and so narrow that only one man could pass at a time. These gaps were guarded by other guerrillas. Gary saw only the tops of their heads and the glint of their rifle barrel amongst the rocks, and he noticed how cunningly the site of the rendezvous had been chosen. Nobody could follow them undetected. An army would not be able to rescue them. They were totally vulnerable, completely at the mercy of these rough, hard men. Gary shivered in the sweltering gut of the canyon. "We'll be damned lucky to get out of this," he muttered to himself, and then aloud, "My leg is hurting. Can't we rest?" But no one even looked back at him, and he stumbled forward to keep as close to Anna as he was able. Quite unexpectedly, long after Gary had relapsed into resigned misery, the Ovambo guide stepped around the corner of a yellow sandstone monolith and into a temporary campsite under an overhanging cliff on the riverbank. Even in his exhaustion and unhappiness, Gary saw that there was a steep pathway up the canyon wall behind the camp, an escape route against surprise attack. "They've thought of everything." He touched Anna's arm and pointed out the path, but all her attention was on the man who sauntered out from the deep shadow of the cavern. He was a young man, half Gary's age, but in the first seconds of their meeting he made Gary feel inadequate and foolish. He didn't have to say a word. He merely stood in the sunlight and stared at Gary with a cat-like stillness about his tall, elegant frame, and Gary was reminded of all the things he was not. His hair was golden, hanging to his bare shoulders, streaked white by the sun, yet as lustrous as raw silk, offering a startling contrast to his deeply tanned features. These might have once been as beautiful as those of a comely girl, but all softness had been burned by the flames of life's furnace, and like forged iron the marks of the anvil had been left upon him. He was tall, but not gawky or round-shouldered, and he was lean, with hard, flat muscle. He wore only riding breeches and boots, and the hair on his chest sparkled like fine copper wire. Around his neck, on a gold chain, he had hung a small gold locket, something that no English gentleman would ever do. Gary tried to feel superior, but under that flat, level gaze, it was difficult. "Colonel Courtney," he said. And again Gary was taken off balance. Though accented, it was the voice of an educated and cultivated man, and his mouth altered shape, losing its hard, stern line as he smiled. "Please do not be alarmed. You are Colonel Courtney, are you not?" "Yes." It took an effort for Gary to speak. "I am Colonel Courtney." "Did you write this letter?" He took the poster from his breast pocket and tried to unfold it, but his hands were shaking, so that it fluttered and tore in his fingers. The man's smile gently mocked him as he nodded. "Yes, I sent for you." "You know where the lost girl can be found?" Anna demanded, stepping closer to him in her eagerness. "Perhaps," he shrugged. "You have seen her?" Anna insisted. "First things come first." "You want money?" Gary's voice was unnecessarily loud. "Well, I have not brought a single sovereign with me. You can be sure of that. If your intention is to rob us, I have nothing of value on me." "Ah, Colonel." The golden man smiled at him, and it was so charming, so unexpectedly exuberant and boyish, that he could feel Anna's stiff and antagonistic stance melt beneath that smile. "My nose tells me that is not true." He sniffed theatrically. "You have something of immense value." "Havana," he said, and sniffed again. "No doubt about it. Havana, Colonel. I must warn you that I would kill for a Havana cigar." Gary took a hurried step backwards involuntarily before he realized it was a jest. Then he grinned weakly and reached for the cigar case in his hip pocket. The golden man inspected the long black cigar. "Romeo y Julieta," he murmured reverently, and then sniffed it lovingly. "A whiff of paradise." He bit off the tip and struck a match off the sole of his boot. He sucked the flame into the cigar and closed his eyes with ecstasy. When he opened them again, he bowed slightly to Anna. "I beg your pardon, madam, but it has been a long time, over 2 years since I tasted a good cigar." "All right," Gary was bolder now. "You know my name, and you are smoking my cigar. The least you can do is introduce yourself. Forgive me." He drew himself up and snapped his heels together in the Teutonic manner. "I am Lothar de la Rey, at your service." "Oh, my God." All Gary's newfound courage deserted him. "I know all about you. There is a price on your head. They'll hang you when they catch you. You are a wanted criminal and a notorious outlaw, sir." "My dear Colonel, I prefer to think of myself as a soldier and patriot." "Soldiers do not go on fighting and destroying property after a formal surrender. Colonel Frank capitulated nearly 4 years ago. I did not recognize Colonel Frank's right to surrender, Lothar interjected contemptuously. I was a soldier of the Kaiser and Imperial Germany. Even Germany surrendered 3 months ago. Yes, Lothar agreed, and I have not perpetrated an act of war since then. But you are still in the field, Gary pointed out indignantly. You are still under arms, and I have not gone in to give myself up yet, for the very good reason that you have so succinctly stated. If I do, your people will hang me. As if under Gary's scrutiny he had suddenly become aware that he was bare to the waist, Lothar reached for his tunic. Freshly laundered, it hung from a thorn bush beside the entrance to the cave. As he shrugged into it, the brass buttons sparkled and Gary's eyes narrowed. "Damn you, sir, your insolence is insupportable. That's a British military tunic. You are wearing one of our uniforms. That in itself is cause enough to shoot you out of hand." "Would you prefer it if I went naked, Colonel?" "It must be obvious even to you that we are in reduced circumstances. It gives me no pleasure to wear a British jacket. Unfortunately, there is no choice. You insult the uniform in which my son died. I take no pleasure in your son's death, just as I take no pleasure in these rags. By God, man, you have the effrontery—" Gary puffed himself up to deliver a devastating broadside, but Anna cut across him impatiently. "Mynheer Delarey, have you seen my little girl?" And Gary subsided as Lothar turned back to her, his features taking on a strangely compassionate cast. "I saw a girl. Yes, I saw a young girl in the wilderness. But I do not know if she was the one you seek." "Could you lead us to her?" Gary demanded, and Lothar glanced at him, his expression hardening again. "I would try to find her again on certain conditions." "Money," said Gary flatly. "Why are rich men always obsessed with their money?" Lothar drew on the cigar and let the fragrant smoke trickle over his tongue. "Yes, Colonel, I would need some money," he nodded, "but not £5,000. I would need £1,000 to equip an expedition to go into the desert fastness where I first saw her. We would need good horses. Ours are almost worn out, and wagons to carry water, and I would need to pay my men. £1,000 would cover those expenses." "What else?" Gary demanded. "There must be some other price." "Yes," Lothar nodded, "there is. I am tired of living in the shadow of the gallows." "You want a pardon for your crimes," Gary stated incredulously. "What makes you think that is in my power?" "You are a powerful man, Colonel, a personal friend of both Smuts and Buerta. Your brother is a general, a cabinet minister in the Buerta government. I would not thwart the course of justice." "I fought an honourable war, Colonel. I fought it to the bitter end, like your friends Smuts and Buerta once fought their war. I am no criminal. I am no murderer. I lost a father, a mother, a wife and a son. I paid the price of defeat in a heavy coin. Now I want the right to live the life of an ordinary man, and you want this girl." "I couldn't agree to that. You are an enemy," Gary blustered. "You found the girl," Anna said softly, "and you will be a free man. Colonel Courtney will arrange it. I give you my word on it." Lothar glanced at her, and then back at Gary, and he smiled again as he divined the true chain of authority here. "Well, Colonel, do we have an agreement?" "How do I know who this girl is? How do I know she is my daughter-in-law?" Gary hedged uncomfortably. "Will you agree to a test?" Lothar shrugged. "As you wish." And Gary turned to Anna. "Show him," he said. "Let him choose." Between them, Gary and Anna had designed this test to thwart the rogues and chances that the reward posters had attracted. Anna snapped open the clasp of the voluminous carpet bag she carried, on a strap over one shoulder, and took out a thick, buff envelope. It contained a pack of postcard-sized photographs, and she handed these to Lothar. He studied the top photograph. It was a studio portrait of a young girl, a pretty girl in a velvet dress and feathered hat. Dark ringlets hung to her shoulders. Lothar shook his head and placed the photograph at the bottom of the pack. Swiftly, he flicked through the rest of them, all of young women, and then handed them back to Anna. "No," he said. "I'm sorry to have brought you so far for nothing. The girl I saw is not amongst those." He looked over his shoulder at the big Avambo. "Very well, Hendrik. Take them back to the drift."
"Wait, Mynheer."
Anna dropped the pile of photographs into the bag and took out another, smaller stack.
"There are more."
"You are careful," Lothar smiled in acknowledgement. "We've had many try to cheat us. £5,000 is a great deal of money," Gary told him. But Lothar did not even look up from the photographs. He turned over two of the pasteboards, then stopped at the third.
"That's her."
Santane de Thierry, in her white confirmation dress, smiled self-consciously up at him.
"She's older now, and her hair..."
Lothar made a gesture describing a thick wild bush. "But those eyes..."
"Yes, that's her."
Neither Gary nor Anna could speak. For a year and a half they had worked for this moment, and now that it had come, they could not truly believe it.
"I have to sit down," Anna said faintly,
and Gary helped her to the log beside the entrance to the cave. While he tended her, Lothar pulled the gold locket from his shirt front and snapped open the lid. He took out a lock of dark hair and offered it to Anna. She accepted it from him almost fearfully, and then with a fiercely protective gesture she pressed the lock to her lips. She closed her eyes, but from the corners of her clenched lids two fat, oily tears squeezed out and began to trickle slowly down her red cheeks.
"It's just the hank of hair. It could be anyone's hair. How do you know?" Gary asked uncomfortably.
"Oh, you silly man," Anna whispered hoarsely. "On a thousand nights I brushed her hair. Do you think I would not know it again?
Anywhere?"